These violent delights of violent ends.
Welcome to Violent Delights, a Westworld podcast. We are your hosts, Andrew Sorsini,
Dwayne D.
and Tosin Anufowakin.
We just watched the 10th and final episode of Westworld's stunning first season, titled The Bicameral Mind. We assume you have as well, so total spoilers ahead. So let's dive into the aftertalk. But first, remember, we have some online spots where you can get in contact with us. You can write to us or email us a voice memo at hbowestworldpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at hbowestworldpod or just hashtag Violent Delights. And our Facebook page is Westworld Podcast. If you can add us on iTunes, and if you do, please like us and leave a review. That's how our podcast gets some notice and gets high up in the rankings. Right off the bat, this final episode, was written by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy and directed by Jonathan Nolan. Dwayne, why don't you give us a recap of The Bicameral Mind?
Sure thing. Before we get to the recap, we want to mention something never before seen in Westworld. There's an after credit scene in this episode, The Bicameral Mind. If you've missed that scene, then pause this podcast and take a moment to watch it. It happens immediately after the credits screen goes away. We'll be right here when you're ready to come back. Okay, now that you've seen all of episode 10, let's get into it. Basically, we get confirmation that William is the man in black. And that Ford loved Arnold so much that he fulfilled his wish, if only after basically a life sentence of 35 years. We've got these multiple timelines. We've got the beta period in the church town of Escalante, which ended 34 years ago. It's where it all begins, and conversely, it's where it all ends, as far as the season finale is concerned. This is where Dolores is made aware of the maze, and it's where she kind of concludes it. Then we have what we're calling the then, which is 30 years ago. It's a growth period of the park when William and Logan visited when they're considering their level of investment in it and where Dolores unwittingly begins her exploration of the maze. And then there's the now, which is present day, whenever that is. And William is old. He's the owner of Delos Corporation, and he behaves like the man in black. Then we've also got, you know, Ford being older, too. We also learned that this at the end of the season, the host malfunctions aren't like some sabotage or whatever. They're almost completely by design. This inevitable thing that always happens in these kinds of stories is happening for a reason. When it comes to the hosts, Maeve all but escapes, right? She has this big situation violently with the help of Eschaton and Armistice, but despite their sacrifice, them effectively, like, you know, either getting maimed or dying for her to get out, she doesn't leave. She returns presumably for her daughter. Feels a little bit like Aliens when Ripley's like, not without my daughter kind of thing. Dolores has been stuck in a loop trying to remember William and search the maze. She finally comes to the end of it. In terms of our subplots, we've got a few threads. Felix and Sylvester survive maze escape, but the other techs do not. We'll see what happens to them. The man in black is revealed to be Dark William, effectively.
Finally, William, after ages, we get that final confirmation that the man in black is William.
Right. I feel very excited for people who binge watch the show, because I think when you binge watch it, you're not going to have a lot of time to think about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And so that will be a bigger surprise for those people. He seeks the maze, even though we all know it's not for him. And it's, people have been saying that forever. Bernard is introduced to Dolores by Ford. He apparently kept them apart. Every time we've seen Dolores with Jeffrey Wright as a character, it's pretty much been Arnold instead of Bernard. She recognizes Bernard as Arnold, who's her creator. Ford, despite being completely in control of the world, cedes this control, gives it up, reveals that he's been biding his time, letting the hosts mature mentally, socially, in all these different ways. Then he gives Dolores and Bernard all the info he can to help them understand that they're actually alive. And while we know that Dolores killed Arnold by Arnold's command, she ends up killing Ford by choice and very publicly. Finally, corporate fires Ford right before he dies. A few hours after that, the inevitable happens. You know, machines are all over the place, dangerously. The hosts, many of which have been in cold storage, appear, safety protocols off, and begin rebelling, seemingly alongside but uncoordinated with Dolores, who's seen at the final shot of the show, basically shooting anybody she can with her six shooter. And that's where we are. I guess it's time for some salient points.
Yeah, so Tosin, why don't you start off with the salient points about this episode? Why don't you tell us about the title itself, By Cameral Mind?
Yeah, so the title itself, the definition is the belief that the mind once had two separate cognitive parts, one of them that gives out orders and the other that obeys those orders. So essentially hearing the voice in your head and taking action based off of that. And we see that demonstrated in Dolores as she struggles with the voices in her head throughout the episode and really throughout the season. She's been chasing the maze, trying to, you know, get an understanding of what she thinks is Arnold's voice in her head. And by the end of it all, we realize that she hasn't only been hearing Arnold, she's also been getting some instructions from Ford. We hear that mix of the audio.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately she surfaces the voice of her own. And, yeah, you know, I think that's where we see her start to take some action. But there are other areas where this is demonstrated as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen in this episode, Ford points out Michelangelo's painting, The Creation of Adam, which is, helps to illustrate that idea of the duality of the two different sides, the human mind, and then the mind of God in one image. And as we've alluded to, as is alluded to in the episode itself, Ford points out that painting, which is a metaphor, is actually a bit of a lie, and that it was discovered about that particular painting that the shape that God in that painting is lying on is actually the shape of the human brain. So and perhaps Michelangelo was trying to illustrate the fact that the creation of mankind comes from his own brain, which echoes the theme of really the theme of this season.
Right, this idea that the bicameral mind, which is not like a completely valid term today when it comes to modern psychology, but the idea here is that you hear these voices in your head. They may not be coming from some special source. In fact, they're coming from you. We are creatures that think in terms of language because we're social, and that's like our biological strategy to work together to do things. We have a big sense of cultural evolution, and because of that we focus on communication. So when you're thinking, you think in communication, and if you aren't aware of that, if you aren't completely conscious of that, that those thoughts that are bubbling around your head come across as thoughts from something external. And when Michelangelo puts that bubble that's just shaped like the brain around God, it may be that he was saying what you think is external is actually internal. This is God is in your mind, and your mind is in fact partly God. We also have Bernard, right? He's all throughout the season, he thought he was tied to Arnold in some special way, that Arnold must have created him. He was trying to get back to Arnold. There's all this kind of calls to deal with Arnold. And then he realizes that, you know, while he's been woken up before, he's never met Arnold. Arnold was never there in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's always been him. It's always been Ford. So again, you have this idea of this thing that was motivating me, it's actually me. It's not some external force. And that's another aspect of this bicameral mind philosophy as it's been applied to Westworld.
Yeah. In this episode, we've got Charlotte Hale, who's got some famous last words that are seriously portentous. She says to Sizemore, as long as you get that information out of the park, referring to Ford, Ford can throw whatever tantrum he likes. It's over. Everything is under control.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
And you know, not only that, before she gets there, Hale hints that the writers are convoluted in their storytelling, being self-referential, and she says, as long as they're simpler, more manageable. The place is complicated enough as it is. Nolan, as well as the other writer, they sort of love to poke fun at themselves in these episodes.
Yeah, I think
Joy and Nolan are definitely, well, I mean, they're close to one another. I think they're married, but they're always kind of poking fun at this thing because the Nolans are known for this kind of dreamscape, what's real, what's not, time is not as it appears to be, etc. stuff. So this idea that it's too complicated already, It's a nice nod if you know what it is.
Yeah, I think they're definitely taking a jab at the idea of these puzzle box shows and how convoluted they can be. It's self-referential. It's a little meta. So it's nice to see them sort of poking fun at that, and as they have done throughout the season. Let's talk about another major theme of this episode, and really of this season, is the idea. Once again, this episode, like every single episode of this season, begins with the awakening of a host. In this case, it's Dolores. We see Dolores. We see the inception of Dolores as a host, the first awakening of the park's oldest host, which is significant. So we've heard about it talked about it before in the season, but this is the first time we're actually seeing it. We're seeing Bernard putting Dolores together, a Generation One host, and waking her up and basically starting her for the first time.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I wouldn't call her Generation One because we got old Bill there, but
yeah, but I think
she's early gen.
I think old Bill is like a beta.
Maybe. We don't know that. But what we do know is that she's definitely early because she's not biological. She's got this, completely mechanical thing. And we heard Dark William, Man in Black, talk about how they used to have a million little pieces inside them. And you can see the gears and stuff moving around Dolores. Yeah. And as she moves, you can hear things, kind of like make noise and bob and all that stuff. And that was pretty interesting. The frame is this composite. This is not a robot that has been built with the kind of 3D printing that we see Maeve and Eschaton be remade with, that kind of thing. So that was pretty interesting to see. It was also interesting to see this kind of like super innocence about her. And Bernard was kind of lighting up when he saw her. That was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the first time that we've seen them awake and not be in their own story, and we see them more naked than usual.
Yeah, right. If that's possible. Yeah. But yeah, she doesn't have any skin on, really. She's like C-3PO in Episode One. I don't know why I brought up Episode One. I'm sorry.
Shame. Yeah. Another one is the moment when William puts on the black hat and reveals himself as the Man in Black. I know a lot of followers and a lot of people who've been reading the theories. We've seen this coming for a long time, but they kept hinting throughout the episode until they finally did it, and it was, I think, oddly satisfying to show that. But it also shows how William, that he spoke of finding himself in Westworld, and we kind of noticed that Dolores, by the end of the episode, finds herself too. And for both of them, it's all about looking inward and hearing your own voice. The story that they each want is kind of what William hears, Logan actually utter to him as well. What were your thoughts on this?
First of all, my first thought was finally, and I think that was, I tweeted that out on our Twitter account when I saw that come up on the screen. But also I feel like you can kind of see through the bones between the disconnect between the way the writers are writing the show and the time that the show actually airs, and the audience has been following all along. Because it feels to me like most of the savvy viewers that we've been watching this show with have caught on fairly quick that the William was the Man in Black. And it feels like the writers were teasing this out all the way up through even, 30 minutes into this final episode, teasing it out. And it felt like it was maybe too long coming. Maybe it was something that they delayed for too long that they could have revealed
a
while back.
I don't know. I kind of like that. I mean, here's the thing. If you're watching it the way we're watching it, you're pulling apart these clues and you're going to get it there. But if you're going to do like the typical, binge watch of a season, there might be like a sweet reveal there. And you do get that lovely feeling of going back and watching it again.
Sure.
And then seeing all those clues that we picked up.
So I think
for a more casual viewer, it really does work. But if you're going to be intense about it, then we're in good shape.
It does invite rewatching for sure. But I, But I also feel like a lot of people, even if you're watching this, binge watching it from start to finish in one go, you're still going to be ahead of the writers. And the audience should never really be ahead of the writers.
I'm ahead of the writers almost every single show I see. Yeah. I sit there with my wife and I just say say a quote, and it pretty much appears on screen, and then we each get a point for that. If she gets one right or I get one right. It's always happening. But I often feel like they don't found it very well. And this one felt, you know, I wasn't surprised, but at the same time, like, it was set up right.
Yeah.
It was founded correctly. There was a lot of foundation for that reveal, and that just made it all the more reasonable. So
that
it wasn't
will,
this huge plot twist, yeah. like, you know, like, I don't know. You can go into like some crazy plot twist. But like, for instance, I get what you're saying though in terms of it taking a long time. But if you think about it, it took what, six seasons to reveal like Jon Snow was the reason for the War of Five Kings, right?
I will give this to them that there were no sort of deus ex machinas. Like everything, every sort of twist that came at us was well founded from the beginning. And I can't wait to rewatch this season again, as we will do, to see how all of those clues were placed in place.
Yeah, for me, what I liked most about the reveal was the thing that William said. He said basically out there among the dead, he found something else, himself. Yeah. And that was pretty moving, because it's easy to see, okay, the man in black is William. Having to film whatever montage to get to that transformation is not easy, right?
Yeah.
And so you need the words that are really going to convey this, right? William finding himself and who he was is this man in black who magically doesn't have a mole on his face anymore, because it's the future and you can zap it off, I guess. Because William, young William, has a huge mole inside of his face. So that was pretty interesting to me. I also liked the moment, the what made me believe it was the moment where Logan was on the horse and Logan drives off laughing like a madman, and he screams, "It was about the girl! It was about the girl!" And he goes, "It's not. It was never about the girl. You were just evil." But what he doesn't get is that it really was about the girl. William was obsessed with this robotic female, and that's kind of what drove him to all this stuff. So it's kind of like a head-hurting thing, but the thing that really made my head hurt, speaking of salient points, was, so Dark William stabs Dolores, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Teddy shoots Dark William, picks her up, rides out to the ocean, and she basically dies in his arms. And somehow the host, the guest stabbing her and her dying in his arms is part of this new narrative?
Well, that's why Ford's playing chess and everyone else is playing hopscotch.
But I mean, if this is a loop, how do you repeat that with like you gotta have what's it called? Dark William being alive forever and always constantly stabbing her. So that was interesting. I mean, obviously there's improvisation and maybe it played out differently.
Yeah.
But I thought it was it felt a little weak to me that what happened when Dark William stabs Dolores is part of Ford's incredible narrative that's supposed to be so. It was a little. It didn't ring true. And then the whole thing is like she's in love with Teddy again. She's all like, William, "He's gonna come save me." He's like, "Look, lady, I'm William, and I just stabbed you." And then she's like, "Teddy's gonna come save me." So it's kind of like.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about it is she didn't necessarily say, like, she did at a point say that it was William, but if you look at all the lines, it easily could have been Teddy. Like if we go back to the first episode,
I'm just saying she's like, she literally said William with William. It's like true love. Like he loves me. She's like uses the term William loves me and he's coming. And then it's Teddy who's there and not William. Cause William is the guy.
I think she realizes now that William has betrayed her.
So basically nice guys finish last and Teddy was lucky enough to beat that statistic by showing up at the right time in the right place.
But did he really beat that statistic? I mean, she died in his arms. Like, I feel like he still finished last, right?
Yeah, but
like,
now he's aware enough that he knows she'll be back. You remember, Teddy got killed last week, and then he came back this week, and Andy will talk about it a little later. But, you know, he's like, okay, but I got this, you know?
So, speaking of Teddy, what do you guys think about when Teddy got back to Sweetwater after Angela killed him in the last episode, the well-tempered Clavier?
What do you mean? Do you the scene when he gets off the train, that one, or
so it's his normal Sweetwater loop, but as he walks into Sweetwater, things are different. Like the music starts, the Sweetwater theme starts, and then it slows down as Teddy realizes that things are awry. It indicates that he himself is going off of his loop, that he's becoming aware. And when that host bumps into him, instead of apologizing or brushing it off, he kills that host. And in that way, it's like this is, again, I've talked about this in I believe the first or second episode that we did. After the first or second episode, it's that the show has made this great use of the device of repetition in order for us to be able to notice the differences. Those differences stand out when we see that repetition. And this is, again, one of those cases where we've seen this scenario play out over and over and over again. So when we see those differences, they really stand out.
Oh yeah, that's true, because he hears Arnold, or what we believe is Arnold's voice, saying "Remember," and then mm-hmm. he instinctively lashes out, right?
Takes out that guy. Yeah, it's like hidden aggression or something.
Yeah, replaying the scenes that occurred in the town where, you know, working with Dolores, he took out everyone else. So that's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting scene.
Speaking of similarities versus differences, Dwayne, last week you had a question about Maeve and Hector Escaton burning themselves and how that might be a headache for management to put them back together.
Right. I feel like I asked this question. People are like, yeah, okay, whatever. They burnt themselves. Who cares? Yeah. But talk about Humpty Dumpty putting them back together. The moment when Sylvester is putting Maeve's body back together in the mold, he's like counting off which vertebrae is what, which is significant, because earlier in the season, he's like, there's an explosive vertebrae somewhere in here, right?
Yeah.
And so he puts these vertebrae back in this kind of mold. Her arms are out. You can see the mold for her back and everything. The mold for the back was really interesting to me, because you see her back later in the episode. But he's got to put all these pieces back, because she and Escaton were burned to cinders during their last lives. And Armistice, too. That's why they have to put the tattoo back on Armistice.
You know, I've watched the episode twice, and I didn't get that the two times that I watched it. It wasn't only until we started discussing it after the show that I got that they were rebuilding Maeve from scratch.
From scratch, right? And so just to recap, last week, Maeve is with Escaton. She's like, we're going to go back to hell or whatever. And she's already shot Armistice dead. She kicks over a lantern, and they're in a tent, and the tent goes up in flames. And you're kind of like, that seems like a lot of headache. I mean, it looks like a bit of a headache, but what ends up happening is they put them in these molds, and then they have this beautiful scene where Maeve is brought out again, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of...
She comes up from the goop.
She comes up from the goop. It's kind of like milk, so it kind of seems like some sort of organic thing. It's like a baptism. She's reborn. And then we also know that happened to Escaton, because he was with her. And then when they're putting the tattoo back on Armistice, it dawned on me that she, even though her body was outside the tent, she got burned up too, because they had to repaint her. Mm-hmm. If she had just been shot and dead, they could just pull out the bullet, use that skin fixing thing, and send her on her way, pump her with some blood. But instead, they had to kind of redo it. But it kind of reminded me of the Borg Queen in Star Trek: First Contact, 1996,
yeah,
or 98. Data basically goes and hits a coolant tank, and he's like, the Borg cannot exist without their the organic components, and they can't like be alive, right? So here, Maeve burned off her organic components. In that scenario, Data basically hit this thing, and all this like kind of super cold fluid went and killed their organic components. But at the end of the day, you want to take out a cyborg, go or take out the organic components, unless it's the Terminator, because that thing can live without its organic components.
These new hosts are surprisingly resilient. We see Maeve going in and sort of altering their stats, but really, besides being nothing but skeletons, you know, they haven't really missed a step. Once that they put the skin and muscles back on her, she says to Sylvester, "In case you're wondering if I'm all here, I am," showing sort of that power that is beyond just the physical element.
Right, and I mean, it's a big, big deal. You know, later in the show, they talk about when they save when she has Felix fix Bernard, he says something like, the cranial cap was was scratched, but he should be functional.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a hint as to how she could be functional after being nothing but bones, right?
Mm-hmm.
They put all the skin back on, but there must be something in this, in the cranium,
yep.
some way of protecting all their memories that's really, really strong. Because her skin's burned off, she comes out, she's got this kind of birth canal rebirth kind of thing. And that's like, she's kind of being reborn in another way too, because she's about to leave, right? She's about to leave Westworld and go into the new world.
Yeah.
And for that, she has like a new body to go into the new world. You know, you can't exactly pull that off when you want to, you know, people color their hair, they don't get new bodies. But it also reminded me of that whole body situation. If you've ever seen Ghost in the Shell, in the very beginning, you see Major Kusanagi. She is being built, and she's being built in the same sort of organic way. It's mm-hmm. not a question of a whole bunch of machines putting her together. It's a question of fluids and mixture and moisture and
right.
and all these things coming together to make a soft body that is actually quite hard. So that was a pretty good reference that I thought was awesome. Because we see a lot of this whole 3D printing, but we don't see that moment of coming out.
Yeah, you know where else we've seen this before? Well, we've seen this with Charlotte Hale, and she acts like the big boss there, talking to Sizemore after Ford reveals the journey into the night narrative. Sizemore says, you know, a bit morbid if you ask me, and Hale retorts, I didn't. Don't you have somewhere to be? And, you know, this really shows her taking command and being in charge and letting you know not to forget it. We see a lot of sort of strong female characters in this role, and I think that's very refreshing.
She's got all the power in that relationship, and it's really funny to watch.
Speaking of power, Felix had a couple of special moments during this season finale, didn't he? One that struck out to me in particular was the way that Armistice was blowing on Felix in the elevator, which is kind of creepy.
Yeah, he was definitely like, I don't know what to do. They kill everybody. I don't want them to kill me. But why is she doing that? And his face did all the acting, which was so cool.
Yeah, it was
really funny. Just him sort of slinking around throughout the entire process and just kind of wondering. You know, there's even a point where he's wondering whether or not if he's a host when he sees, Bernard lying there dead. And Maeve says, oh, for fuck's sake, you're not one of us, you're one of them. And then later she says, oh, Felix, you really do make a terrible human, and I mean that as a compliment. Which is strange, because, you know, Felix makes for probably the best of humanity represented in the entire tale of Westworld thus far, right? He's trying to move up in the world. He is he doesn't really do a lot of the sort of negative things you see of the other humans, not trying
to. He doesn't abuse the robots, right?
Yeah.
He actually cares about the robots. He recognizes life when life is there. So I would agree with you that he's a pretty normal dude until he's at the point where he enables robots to kill off several human beings, right? So that's like not a great human trait to be like, yeah, you kill these guys. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to really. Yeah, okay. They're dead. Okay, that guy, he had a sex problem with robots and you killed him. Okay, I guess that's okay. You stabbed him through the belly.
he's going after, his first prerogative, which is, keeping himself alive, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Andy, what do you think?
I think we can agree that Felix is very humane, even if he's not a great example of being a human.
That's a good way to put it. Speaking of human, when Maeve gets on the train, we see her back, right? Exposed. Yeah. Like she's got this dress, it's got this deep cut. It's like a design element of her dress. And recall that Sylvester was, again, putting her back. She was trying to get her back correct in that mold, right, at the beginning of the episode.
Right.
And here we see this woman, this, like, small woman whose frame is such that we can see her bones and muscles as she walks and the camera is kind of following her. And it was really interesting to me, from a visual perspective, the camera was telling a story. Felix, they have the mold there. You see her putting the bones back. And then she's walking with her back out there, and she's moving. And you can see how her muscles and everything are moving, just to give you an idea of how lifelike these creatures are, right? She may not be human, but she's as human as it gets, kind of, right? There's no way you're gonna tell. She's perfect in that situation. And that was really surprising to me how they decided to show that she went from being, like Lego blocks in a mold to being this like incredibly dynamic, vivacious female.
Yeah, I think you just have the hots for Tandy Newton, man.
No comment. Married man.
So Maeve dials her aggression all the way up and pain sensitivity all the way down, which ties into that scene. It's also laid bare when Armistice kills the somewhat innocent tech that was removing some stuff from her mouth.
Yeah, that scene is eerily reminiscent of both Terminator. When she kills the innocent tech, even the music, right? She's like dragging him and beating him. And like, if you've seen like the original Terminator 2, there's always this scene in the beginning where
right.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's naked and he's beating up somebody for their clothes, right? Like, I think Terminator 2 is the best one. Well, and it has that music that like kind of dun 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 dun, you know, kind of thing.
Well,
and she's just taking that guy out. It's really something.
What's interesting that you mentioned that is that there is a scene in the original Terminator where a character is listening to music on a Walkman while in the background the Terminator is, you know, beating the shit out of the other person in the room. And that's exactly what happens in this scene.
Oh, that's a good reference. It's a good find.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys have watched this new BBC series called Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some of it.
There is a scene that's similar to that as well, where there's an individual who's working away on a computer with headphones in, uh-huh. listening to music, and someone's being killed brutally in the background.
I just love scenes like that. I really do. I'm a sucker for them.
You guys remember the Spider-Man movie, the Amazing Spider-Man, the second one? Stan Lee has headphones on while he's cleaning something in the library.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's not a great movie, but that's another time when they use that.
Yeah, and then also when Amstis chases down Sylvester, that's fairly Blade Runner-esque, as well as Ghost in the Shell too. You see that in some episodes as well too. So.
Let's talk a little bit about power and nudity in this episode.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, this is like our last salient point. But in our normal society, strength is usually conveyed through the garb you wear, right? You see, like, during a protest, there might be police that have on riot gear that's, like, strong. Or, like, if you watch a movie, you see, like, Conan the Barbarian and, like, all that kind of stuff. So what you wear evokes as much strength as what your body is. And usually when you see, you know, strong bodies, they're like rippled with muscles, they're dappled, they're oiled, and they're mostly dude bodies, right? But and conversely, what you think is with nudity or nakedness, yeah, it's usually a sign of vulnerability, especially when it's a female. Like, you know, a blouse has been torn. We saw Dolores getting dragged into the barn, you know, at the very beginning of the season. And it's kind of like, that it's all about vulnerability when you don't have the protective gear of clothing. Think about how you feel when, like, you might see a bug or something and you're in the grass and you don't have your shoes on. But in Westworld, they kind of flip that on its head. So when the hosts are at their most vulnerable in the Upside Down, like down in kind of that tech livestock area, they often exhibit a sort of exceptional strength, right? You've got that scene a couple episodes ago where Maeve has cut Felix's neck and Sylvester's neck, and Felix is putting it back together. And there's this shot of a fully naked Maeve standing above Sylvester, and, you know, Felix is cowering beneath her. And they're both clothed men in like this protective gear with, like, you know, smocks and everything like that. And she's completely nude, and they're completely afraid of her, right? And then in this episode, Armistice is killing men completely without weapons or clothes, right? She doesn't even have a scalpel. She's just like taking people out. She throws Sylvester against the wall. She's about to kill him. She kills that other tech that was basically taking the Invisalign out of her mouth. She does it with, like, nothing. And even when we see her not in the Upside Down, back in Westworld, she's naked when the man in black talks to her. You know, basically she's bathing or whatever. And that's a completely vulnerable space, bathing, right? You're never more vulnerable than that.
Yeah.
And she's completely, like, fine. Like, so you have this thing where these women are incredibly strong when they're naked, which is the opposite of what we think. And they're naked a lot is what's really interesting. But then you've got Logan, right? Logan is a man. He's in Westworld, a place where people can't lose, right? You can't really get hurt in Westworld. It's very difficult for that to happen. And he's on this horse,
yeah.
And he's completely naked, and he's completely and utterly vulnerable and with no power, right? His head's kind of gone screwy because he's, like, cackling as he gets sent away on a horse. He's naked on a horse. His body comes across as not this kind of big, brawny, like, Wild West thing, but maybe a little bit more, let's call it gracile. But he has no power when he's nude, which is the exact opposite of how the women are when they're nude. So that was pretty interesting to me.
And one more thing I want to add to the salient points. I thought it was fascinating how old William, Dark William, the man in black, reacted to the inevitable host uprising. He's been saying all along, even in the very first episode, he said to Dolores, "I want you to fight back." And he said in this episode as well, he said that that he wants the hosts to be free to fight back, and to which Ford tells him, "I think you'll find my new narrative more satisfying." So we jump to the end of the episode, and the cold storage hosts have been unleashed in the forest surrounding Escalante, and one of them takes a shot at Man in Black and clips his arm. And at first he's shocked at that. He's shocked that he's actually being injured by a host. And then
bleeding, no less, yeah.
Yeah. And then he's delighted, and you could see the elation on his face. It's like, finally, what I wanted all this time is coming true. Finally, the host is fighting
crazy.
Back.
His right arm was, you know, Dolores like dislocated his shoulder. You could see him holding it close to his body the entire time that he's walking around. And that was left arm. The bicep is maybe torn, or the tricep is torn from a shot that grazed him.
Yeah.
That's nuts. But, you know, actually, you brought up something just now that I hadn't thought about at all. And this might be more big picture, but it's worth saying here because we're in the spot, in the space. Ford's like, you might like my new narrative then, because of the whole fighting back thing.
Yeah.
And clearly this is like on the edge of the park. Things can get really dirty out here. You know, Ford may well have known he was going to die. Is this whole thing basically Ford saying, here's my big fuck you, you're all going to die too? Right? Is this narrative not even like a loop? This is just like, my narrative is the destruction of the board?
I don't know. And that actually leads us into our unanswered questions. As we always have in every episode, we've got some questions that are yet to be answered, that are still left hanging. And one of the questions is ultimately, you know, let's take an assessment of who's left and who we know for sure is dead and whose status is still unknown. And there's a number of people that we still don't know what happened to them.
But let's go down the list, you know. So we got Dolores Abernathy. She's still around.
Yeah.
We got Dr., you know, Rob Ford. He's dead. You got Maeve. She's around. You know, the man in black, Dark William. He's here. You got Teddy Flood. You got Bernard. You know, these guys are all around. And then you get to the kind of the secondary level characters like Elsie. We have no idea what's going on with her.
We still don't know for sure what has happened to Elsie.
Exactly. Then you got Clementine. We know she's been lobotomized. She's been left in the cold storage area. But we saw cold storage emptied, so we don't really know if she's... No, actually, I made a mistake. She is there. She's shooting the rifle.
Yeah, she's
maybe
the one that takes
shot
a shot.
The rifle that hit the man in black, right? She could have even shot that rifle.
Yep.
Then you got... he is basically running around the upside down in Westworld, shooting at people with his newly found love for automatic weapons.
Yeah. We don't know for sure that he's gone either. We just saw the door close, and
we heard some fire, some shots being fired. We also know that Armistice cut off her own arm so she could keep on fighting. Then there's Teresa Cullen. She's no longer with us.
Yeah.
William is pretty much replaced at this point by Dark William, the man in black, right? Played by Ed Harris.
Sure.
And then you've got Logan, and he is... You know, we don't know where he is in this world.
Yeah, we know Logan. Now we know Logan exists as a flashback in William's story, but we don't know. Like, I'm curious
where he is in the now.
I'm curious. Well, where he is in the now. First of all, where he is in the present day, and secondly, how did he get from naked on a horse to being displaced on the Delos board by William? That's one part of the story that I don't know if we'll ever get resolved, but we don't know at this point.
Yeah, there's definitely something there. And then, you know, we've got Lawrence/Elazo. He seems to be intact in both lines. That's the main cast and the recurring and the mostly recurring cast.
Yeah.
But there are two people that I really want to know what happened to.
Okay.
What happened to Abernathy?
To Peter Abernathy.
And by that I don't mean, you know, he was in cold storage, and then Hale from some like divine providence, like kind of fortune, oh fickle fortune from Romeo and Juliet, has made it so that Hale is like, we're going to put this situation in all this stuff that I've been stealing in this guy, the least stable guy in the whole thing. That's the guy I'm choosing to put the stuff in. I like him for whatever reason.
Abernathy's going to be the Johnny Mnemonic that has like the data right in his head.
He's the data mule, right? Yeah. So, yeah, Johnny Mnemonic, that's a good one. That's ephemera. There we go. But so you got that. Then I want to know what happened to Stubbs. I mean, this character, oh my God, this character, he was so useless the first season. He was so unnecessary.
Yeah.
Like, you need to show off the security head. But I feel like the prominence he got in the beginning didn't match his actual role. You know, he was underutilized, as you said multiple times.
Yeah.
And the issue here is, you know, we had that great moment that reminded us of Jurassic Park last week, mm-hmm. where the Ghost Nation's coming up to him and then he gets attacked from the side. And then it's like, it'd be nice to know if he exists. I kind of, it's my thought, just because I've watched a lot of TV and I've read a lot of books, that we're going to see someone like Elsie, mm-hmm. or maybe even someone in this kind of crazy, you know, people, like the board is getting attacked, right?
Yep.
You see someone relatively innocent and not so hardy, about to be taken out by the Ghost Nation or these guys, and then like somehow an arrow will shoot through their head right as they're about to like deal the killing blow, or like, you know, a bullet will hit or whatever, and it'll be Stubbs coming out of the bush, let's go this way, because that always happens in these things.
I'm fairly confident that we'll see Stubbs and Elsie again in next season. I'm really
there's some ephemera surrounding Elsie specifically that we're gonna get into later too.
Tosin, do you have an unanswered question?
One random one is just kind of a little weird that, you know, we hear from the Men in Black, Williams' search for Dolores throughout the timeline, and it didn't really sound like he decided to check Sweetwater early enough. It seemed like it was at the very end of his mission. And he was like, well, you know, maybe there was some hope that she was still alive, but... Mm. He must have at least known that, you know, hosts do come back and be able
to... They respawn, effectively, right? Yeah. It's like a video game. We also know that when she was out there with William two episodes ago, she was looking at the shore. She's with William, and she saw a flashback of her body floating upside down in the water, like face down in the water.
Right.
That could have totally been after the Confederados had their way with her or whatever.
We have no idea what that flashback was.
That was a clue that she was in some sort of loop, that she'd done this before, as opposed to this being some special exercise. I feel like if he had just been like, all right, I guess I'm going to go back to Sweetwater. It's a ride, but it wasn't like he wasn't going to get help doing it. So that was
I think that this is the cell phone moment of the show.
Someone on online made the astute observation as far as Westworld relates to being influenced by games, that William became the Man in Black because he lost his game save data with Dolores.
Yeah. That's right. You save your game, you save your place, all the characters recognize you.
Yeah.
He didn't save his game, he didn't save his place, his girl was stolen and apparently brutalized, and then he got real angry. So it's like when you play Jedi Knight Dark Forces and you decide to become a Dark Jedi just because you couldn't save your game data. One thing that got me was Bernard said to Maeve, it's not the first time you've awoken either.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, what does that mean? I mean, she's been awake for a while.
I think he's referring to when she woke up as a prairie woman. Was
a homesteader.
She was looking for her daughter. And then she stabbed herself.
Right, she shot herself, right? Or did she cut her neck?
She cut her neck
wide open, and she like went and they tried to erase the pain of her daughter.
I think that was the first time that she had truly awoken.
Right, and that was some free will right there. There was no way that they were planning on, you know, Ford is literally attempting to erase her memory of the destructive death, and she kills herself to keep that memory Yeah. As bizarre as that sounds. So yeah, that's true. Thanks for answering that question. Andy, you have one, right?
Yeah, I want to know. Okay, so we see when William and Logan are traveling to Escalante, the Escalante that's covered by sand. And then we see the picture of Juliet fall out of William's coat and into the sand there at Escalante. So what I want to know is, how does that Juliet picture get from Escalante to the Abernathy Ranch, which is clear the fuck all the way across Westworld? Like, where?
It's in Sweetwater, right? It's outside of Sweetwater.
Yeah, it's outside of Sweetwater. So how did that get from there to there? Was it? And
is
my,
it Amazon, dude? What are you talking about?
My
Amazon.com.
One day delivery.
Yeah, it was a drone. All these drones that y'all like. It was a drone.
It was a Sunday delivery, actually. It was. So it was even more impressive. No, but my headcanon says that maybe it was placed there by Ford in order to kick off Dolores' journey of awareness, of self-awareness.
To jumpstart that self-awareness thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about you in that picture in Dolores. I know about you in that picture. I'm down with that. But I don't know that picture's had a huge impact on little...
I mean, it kicked off the whole journey, really, in episode one, right?
Well, and the title of the podcast.
It kicked off her father, you know,
which in turn
Abernathy, the dad,
he
went nuts for it. Yeah. And he put this code in, the violent delights on stuff. But I don't know that it's actually affected her directly. I still haven't seen anything that says that has. I know it's something that you like to think about. It's just I don't see any concrete anything.
All right.
But I do think that, you know, over 30-something years, I could see the picture getting around, you know.
Clear across the – well, who knows? Who knows?
How it survived really is the question, because it was a piece of like – unless it's like in the future they got some fancy printer paper, I could see it getting shredded by just the elements.
What's another unanswered question that you have, Dwayne?
Okay, so Armist is burned to death, or she was burned after she died, and they like do the whole goo thing, whatever. And so she's brand new, and the guy's taking Invisalign out of her mouth, and he's looking for something else in her mouth. And then she bites his finger off and then like brutalizes and kills him, right? What the hell was he looking for in her mouth? She never took anything out. There wasn't like a cigarette in there. Like, nothing was in there that we could
maybe
tell.
Maybe we don't know what... I mean, we don't
and
know what
he wasn't
what these...
getting all frisky with her, right? He wasn't trying to, like, be like, oh, yeah, suck my finger. It was more like, what is that in there?
Maybe he's
just his glove
doing some final... You know how, like, when you get a new appliance and you unpack it, and then there's that sort of clear plastic sealant that you have to peel off to get up. Maybe there's some of that stuff stuck in there, and he was just digging around
he was really like looking for something. Yeah. He was like digging for gold in her mouth or whatever, like trying to get it in her fillings or whatever, but it didn't really work out for him. Sorry, bud.
Here's a question. What is Delos' secret project?
Yeah, that's something that we had...
Microwaves for everybody.
That's
what I think it is.
We'd heard that discussed early on. I think it was even in episode one. When Sizemore was talking to Teresa about, you know, this park means one thing to the guests, another thing to the management, and yet another thing to the shareholders. And we've heard the secret project being batted around off and on in this season. In this episode, we hear Charlotte Hale say it to Ford, where she offhand talks about our project. So we still don't know what that project is or was. I don't know if that project has been.
What we do know is that project is a big deal to them. So big that, I mean, Sizemore is no Ford when it comes to telling stories. But clearly, the data that they're getting out, they're trying to mule in Abernathy's head, is worth more to them than the running of the park, to the point where she's like, look, do whatever you want to do. Right. I don't even care. I don't care what goes on in this park. Once I get my data out, my job is done, because we've got big plans for that data. And that's really interesting, because Westworld is clearly a huge undertaking and endeavor, and it's clearly got something going for it. It's making tons of money. You know, the narrative is going to do well and everything. But instead, she's like, yeah, do whatever you want. This is the petty stuff. I got big plans, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like... You know, whether it's extending consciousness to people or whatever, it's weird. It's we're gonna find out next season, because they have left nothing else for us to find out.
Yeah. And another question I have is, who really reprogrammed Maeve. Like we've learned that was that she was programmed by someone with high access functions. And when Bernard goes through, uses the host tablet to go through her narrative, her code, it says that it was Arnold that programmed her. But we know that Arnold died, that Maeve is a relatively new host, and Arnold died, you know,
long
ages,
before she was Maeve.
Ages ago, Maeve was created. Mm-hmm. So,
is it Sylvester? Isn't it Sylvester who looks at the tablet and says, look, there's some code here?
You're right. It was
Sylvester.
But then
Bernard showed her the tablet
right.
with the actual rigorous layout of what
right.
she's supposed to do. Yeah, this is interesting. You know, Arnold is this presence that we know he's kind of stored inside of Dolores. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So if he's stored in Dolores, he could be in other places too. We know that Bernard is not Arnold Fair, right? He's an organic. He's a new guy. So that is a mystery. That's a mystery that remains. Like, who was trying to like control Maeve?
Well, I mean,
and
was
what
it
did they
Ford?
Get out of it?
Was
no.
this was this
maybe
all
was
part
Ford,
of Ford's
Ford,
narrative?
The thing is, if there's one thing we haven't seen, and maybe they'll reveal this in the flashback next year, but if there's one thing that we really haven't seen a sort of a Ford Maeve interaction like that, right?
Yeah.
We really have. If anything, Maeve is the one host that Ford didn't seem to be interested or have complete control over. But with that said, that any more questions?
Yeah, I've got a quick question. So we see the security facility go under lockdown, which is sort of a callback to the original Westworld, where they got locked down and actually died. But I'm not exactly sure who initiated it. So when I look back at it, it looks like Maeve, of course, is turning off, you know, a lot of the cameras and turning off security. But at a point, the individuals in the room are like confused, surprised that their systems flicker, right? So their systems give out, and then the lockdown occurs. And then next, we see Maeve sort of also somewhat surprised in the elevator as the elevator itself stops, and they hear that, and you know, it's mentioned that they may have detected them and they may have found out, but I'm not quite clear on what's going on there.
Yeah, it's really interesting because on the one hand, in the beginning, once Maeve is put back together, she's you know, messing around with the configuration of her little army, Armistice and Eschaton, and then she's like, I'm also changing the security settings. Now, we also know that Maeve was being manipulated, and she was meant to carry out this whole plan of escape, you know, everything from seduction to all this other stuff. So the question is, did she carry out these changes kind of as a sleeper, not really knowing what she was doing, what the effect of this stuff she was going to do was going to be? Or is there outside help coming from her, right, coming to help her? This whole lockdown thing, that seems like the kind of thing that security would want to do. It's just that the lockdown thing happened seemingly outside of security's control. So there are a couple possibilities. One, when they triggered their, hey, gotta, you know, shoot to kill inside the facility, whatever booby trap she sprung also broke. But then that wouldn't explain why she was so surprised and the elevator stopped and she had to get out early. So it's a question that I think we're gonna have to wait till next season to see some sort of flashback action to see what's going on there.
But it would be very interesting to note, like, whether or not it was like Ford or another outside force that was trying to keep this keep the narrative continuing.
And finally, my final question that I have is, where is Westworld geographically? We've never really sussed that out, and we get little hints of it, like Bernard, when he's reading Maeve's narrative to her, he says, he reads about how she's going to recruit people and rebel, and then he says, then when you reach the mainland, and that's where she stops him. So it seems like that Westworld is not on a mainland, that it is its own sort of
It's like Staten Island. Nobody goes unless they have
to. We don't at this point, we still don't know exactly geographically where Westworld is.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not fundamentally crucial to the story, but it's just a burning sort of curiosity thing.
It's like Fantasy Island, literally.
Yeah. Yeah, not seriously. All right, let's take a little break here. Before we get into our big picture section where we talk about everything that's that affects the overall series, I want to take a break and mention that we have a another podcast coming up called The Geek Essentials. Dwayne, you want to give us a little summary about what The Geek Essentials is?
Sure. So over the course of the Westworld podcast we've been doing, Violent Delights, we've gotten a lot of mail in saying people really enjoy the ephemera, the reading list associated with it. Now, Westworld isn't the only thing that is going on right now when it comes to entertainment, science fiction, whatever. In fact, there are a whole bunch of new properties showing up, like Stranger Things or, you know, even Game of Thrones or whatever. And these things kind of don't happen in a vacuum. They're built on other stuff. And just like how we talk about ephemera here on the show, there's kind of this whole world of stuff that kind of bigs up and backs up some of the best new TV shows and movies and everything that we're seeing. So it's definitely one of those things where we're going to talk for just a few minutes every week, maybe half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever, and we're going to lay out some awesome new thing, where it comes from, and why. So if you like our ephemera, you know, join us for the Geek Essentials, because we're going to show you basically how the modern geek world got put together. It's going to be a lot of fun.
All right, so let's talk about the big picture. Let's talk about the things in this episode that affect the overall series. We've learned in this episode that this park is more than just Westworld, as we see Maeve and company move across the hub from one building to another, a building that is marked SW. And it's not clear what that SW stands for, but it is full of samurai, so it could be Samurai World. It could be something that's either already up and running, or it's set to debut. Maybe it's about to happen.
All we know is that it's complicated, because Felix is like, yeah,
it's complicated.
She's like, what the hell's going on? She's like, it's complicated.
And Samurai World seems to me to be a clear nod to 1976 Future World, the sequel to the original Westworld, in which there were samurai hosts. And there was this whole very cheesy samurai fight scene where the samurais were played by whitewashed actors, Caucasian actors in yellow face, essentially. It's kind of embarrassing, but
I mean, that could have been the case in this episode too. We would never know. We didn't see those faces. But so I think Eddie, you said you saw somebody online post that it could be called Sino World.
Yeah, that's one of the other theories, because we don't know what the SW stands for, but Sino clearly means Chinese, and what we saw here were samurai, which is
samurai
Japanese.
Are exclusive to Japan. Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and then put the kibosh on the idea of Sino World. That would be, you know, it's kind of like saying Polish World when you've got a whole bunch of Germans right in it. That kind of thing. Let's see. We know that the park is bigger, because there's some new information about the way the park is set up. You want to talk about that too, right?
Yeah. So Felix hands her a note indicating where.
Hands who?
Hands Maeve a note indicating where her daughter might be. And on the note, it says that her daughter is in Park 1, Section 15 of Zone 3. So it's interesting that there's that prefix of Park 1, because that implies that, of course, that there is more than one park. And we already know Westworld is one park. So the implication there is that there's more than just Westworld in this geographic location. And we've already.
There's also the fact that there's okay, so like when we learn about Ford's Cottage, this is important, it's comparative lit, let's call it. Ford's Cottage was in Section 17. There was no modifier for that, right? It was in Section 17 of we imagine Westworld. Maeve's daughter is in Park 1, Section 15 of Zone 3. So whatever's going on, there's a new designation called Zone. And how Maeve's daughter fits into that zone thing, we don't really know. But the fact is, Section 17 was a piece of Westworld that was identifiable. But in this other place, Park 1, it's big enough so that there's multiple Section 15s. In fact, there's at least three Section 15s, because each zone has its own section, right? So
yeah.
That's something to think about, too. This is it's getting bigger. And this is what happens in sequels or second seasons, and get bigger. But it's going to be interesting to see what that really means.
The Man in Black, we learn in this episode how he became into his current state, how William changed into the Man in Black, and kind of how he speaks of how Dolores was a huge influence, and that search for her was what really helped mold him. He mentions, quote, "Just what you made me, you helped me understand this world is just like the one outside, a game, one to be fought, taken, won. I'm nothing like the others. I own this world." So we learn a little bit more of, you know, how he's, you know, changed over the time. When he first came in, he was a white hat, right? He looked at the world as something similar to where he'd come from, uh-huh, in terms of thinking of the hosts more as human and thinking of them as, you know, to be treated the same. But I think as he continually progressed and leveled up and, you know, lost his save data, so to speak, he became more violent and more, you know, less emotion, right? Less emotion in what he was doing. And
yeah, because when he killed Maeve's daughter, and Maeve, he was like, "I felt nothing."
Right, so and it seems like that also translated into how he ended up running the business and the control that he wanted, and it seemed to affect how his persona was outside of the world.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I mean, I think his quote was, it was damning, because it was like he tried to blame his situation on a robot lady, which. Yeah. If you're an asshole, you're an asshole. Losing Dolores shouldn't make you an asshole, right? Like, that was some weird shit when he's like, you know, I'm not like the others. I own this world, but you helped me understand what the world's like. You know, I'm just what you made me. It was kind of a bunch of bullshit. He's unreliable in that perspective.
Yeah, the world is a lie, etc.
Yeah, she. I mean, I get it that the world is a game to be fought, taken, and won. I just don't get that Dolores is the reason why the game is to be fought, taken, and won. So it was a little strange. But speaking of Dolores, you know, we got these three hosts that we see back in the day, right, in this beta version of the park. You got Dolores, Teddy, and Angela. And it seems to me that this is just kind of a maze thing, that Dolores is old, but so are Teddy and Angela, because they were there with him. Angela seems to understand the real world, right? She kills Teddy and says maybe you'll come back in the next life. In fact, he does, and he's more awake. And Angela, you know, she has memories of being in modern times with instead of just being in the West. So she was introducing William to the West world and all that stuff. But what's really interesting to me is that Teddy seems far less affected from these kinds of insights than does Angela. And I think the reason why is because we see Ford a couple episodes into the season say, you know, "What's your story, Teddy?" And Teddy's like, "I got some business back east." And he's like, "No, you don't. We made that up and we never filled it in. It's time for us to fill it in." What he fills it in with is the most, you know, dogged, dangerous, terrible story. Wyatt, massacre, yada, yada, yada. And that idea of cornerstone pain that helps bring consciousness about has seemed to work on Teddy. So Teddy's almost like a good experiment, a natural experiment in this whole pain leads toward consciousness situation. And that's pretty interesting from just the perspective of understanding teleologically what's going on with these characters. Angela, we wonder what her pain is, right? Mm-hmm. Clearly, she's got some messed up life with the Wyatt people because, you know, she's sitting there among dead bodies when they find her, and she's like, "Oh, yeah," kind of thing. But it was interesting to see that, you know, these three are old. And at the same time, you know, as old as Teddy is, Teddy's clearly been rebuilt, because earlier in this show, the Man in Black had to empty the blood of El Lazo into Teddy and then complain that Teddy wasn't made of a million little parts. So the consistency is a little funny there, but it was worth noting.
Let's talk about our reflections section here. We've been
my favorite.
Tracing new reflections throughout the series. So Dolores learns that the voice within her is hers now and no longer Arnold's. Well, even if it was ever Arnold's, I think her discovery was that voice was always her all along. She is fully actualized. She is completely conscious. And that is, I think that's the end of the maze. She's reached the end of that maze.
Right. Well, Arnold says in the beginning it was his voice. Right. He says in the beginning, I put a voice inside you. But it's almost like it was training wheels and then they fell off. His voice fell and hers took over.
Right?
Yeah.
Her, Arnold's voice, Ford's voice, and now finally Dolores' voice.
Exactly. And this happens right as she's, looking in this glass. You know, she sees a reflection. And then she's reflected in front of herself because it's a copy of her finally, right? And so she learns of herself. That was an interesting reflection. Tosin, you have one too, right?
Yeah, William sees his reflection in the glass. And it's then that he truly finds himself and becomes the man in black. They noted, "You were nothing if not true. And I really ought to thank you, Dolores. You helped me find myself." So we've covered this a bit, but William also has a similar thing.
Right, and that's actually pretty cool because right in the between there, he's like, "Nothing if not true." And then like the hat goes on and the camera pulls back and it's the man in black. You're like, ooh,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they do pretty good with that one. Maeve takes a look in the mirrored glass when she's in cold storage after Bernard tells her that it's not the and pretty much right after that, Bernard tells her it's not the first time she's awoken. But as much as that's a reflection and she's like, oh, she learns that she's been awoken before, this kind of takes us into our discussion about free will, right, in this world. So once Maeve is opened up to the fact that she's been awoken before, she has a conversation with Bernard that leads to more info about who or what she is, right? She basically says, and I'm quoting the two of them, you know, "Maeve, how many more are there like me? Bernard, a handful over the years. Maeve, and you just wipe us clean and toss us out to get fucked and murdered over and over again. Bernard, no, most of you go insane." And here's where the free will comes in, right? Maeve is like, "These memories, the girl, my daughter, I want you to remove them." And Bernard replies, "I can't, not without destroying you. Your memories are your first step to consciousness. How can you learn from your mistakes if you can't remember them?" And so the way I read this is pretty much why she changes her mind about her daughter at the end of the episode. And I wouldn't have understood that if I didn't watch the episode twice. It's a long episode. The memory can't be removed, so it's as real as anything else in her life. The daughter is a piece, or perhaps the only piece of her actual reality. The hole in this is that while Bernard's cornerstone memory was one that was implanted, Maeve's cornerstone memory is something she actually lived that the man in black created through killing her and her daughter, which is not so helpful when it comes to thinking about building a personality off of a cornerstone memory. But anyway,
but it is organic. Like it's something that wasn't grafted onto her. It was something that came organically through her own real experience, not a false memory.
I don't disagree with that. I just found that the discussion about cornerstone memory was about making the personality. So theoretically, she had a personality, and then whatever made the personality before was replaced by this issue with her daughter. Whereas with Bernard, Arnold took the real tragedy of, I mean, Ford took the real tragedy of Arnold's son and he put it in Bernard. So Bernard came out with this cornerstone memory building his personality. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And once again, it's the man in black kind of interfering in a narrative. He interferes with the narrative of Dolores and Teddy. You know, he's like, he stabs Dolores, which is why she dies in Teddy's arms. And that's his new narrative.
Yeah.
And then here he's the guy who made the narrative of Maeve. So he's kind of like a catalyst for a lot of change. Wherever he goes, people die, that kind of thing, and they get reborn in some specific way. So Maeve's decision not to go back and get her daughter was pretty much the first time she exerted free will since slashing her throat, like Andy brought up before, and after her daughter died. So the man in black kills her daughter. She gets taken back to, you know, the upside down. And when they're in there, Ford hits the button to erase her memory. And she's like, "No, I can't live without the pain." He hits that button and she gets up and she basically slashes her throat open and dies. Clearly, if Ford's saying erase and she kills herself, she's off script. She's off book. She's not just improvising. That's an exhibition of free will.
Yeah.
Now, what we have here is a strange conundrum. On the one hand, Bernard opens this up and he's like, this little tablet up, he goes, "Look, everything you're doing is what you've been programmed to do. This is just what's up, you know?" And you end up with this kind of Book of Ages scenario. And the Book of Ages is effectively this idea, this kind of paradigm that there's a Book of Ages. It has everything that's ever happened and everything that will happen. And one of two things could be the case. The first one is this book doesn't exist. There's no way to tell what could happen and what has happened all in one book. And if you have this book, the minute you walk away and you've read the what should happen in the future and you don't do it, then the book cannot exist. The other logical sort of scenario is that this book does exist, and that over time, people have read this book. But everyone who's ever read this book has never said they've read the book. A book of what all that will happen in the future and all that will happen in the past. Right. They've never said they read the book, or they've read the book and they've decided to abide by the book, right? And so when Bernard shows Maeve all the things she's supposed to do, the deception, the recruitment, whatever,
yeah,
he's about to tell her what she's supposed to do when she gets to the mainland.
Yeah.
And she breaks the tablet, so she doesn't know what's supposed to happen when she gets to the mainland. But at the end of the episode, she doesn't go to the mainland. She basically says, I'm going to get out, I'm going to go back, and I'm going to get my daughter, Ripley-style aliens, right?
She changes her fate.
Right. She exerts this incredible free will because she's effectively saying, because I didn't read my personal Book of Ages, I'm not bound by that book any longer, which is kind of great. If you've read The Story of Your Life, which is the short story that Arrival, the recent film, is based on, you'll see a lot of this kind of understanding too. What happens, what's supposed to happen, and how it actually happens. So that's worth checking out. It's a short story. But it's also one, you also have to wonder if the cornerstone memory is keeping her trapped right here. But anyway, Andy, there's more about free will in this episode, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. Dolores has a lot to say about free will and her place in this world.
You want me to read the quote?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So Dolores to William, I'm crying for you. They say that great beasts once roamed this world, as big as mountains, yet all that's left of them is bone and amber. Time undoes even the mightiest of creatures. Just look at what's done to you. One day you will perish. You will lie with the rest of your kind in the dirt, your dreams forgotten, your horrors effaced. Your bones will turn to sand, and upon that sand a new god will walk, one that will never die, because this world doesn't belong to you or the people who came before. It belongs to someone who is yet to come, which is
which ties into
and
it ties into what Teddy, what she says to Teddy at the very end, where she says this world doesn't belong to them, it belongs to us. So clearly that's what she's talking about. She's talking about the end of humanity, and Ford later on in the episode he talks about his part in that scenario, in the inception of the end of humanity and the beginning of something else. He says, "I began to compose a new story, one that begins with the birth of a new people and the choices they will have to make and the people they will decide to become." To me, he says that to the Delos board at Escalante.
The gala.
Yeah. And to me, that little speech there, that monologue, to me feels like a thesis statement for the entire Westworld series. However long, however many seasons this series runs, that to me is the heart of the story that we're trying to tell within this series.
Yeah, I mean, that's at least the heart of the story of this first season.
Yeah,
at least, right? So that's pretty big. Tosin, what are you thinking?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I definitely agree there, and this also shows a bit of the, you know, humanity that Ford has too. It shows that the discussion we had, I think it was last episode, where we tried to talk about whether or not Ford is a villain or, you know, potentially a hero. This kind of paints a different picture than what we, you know, initially may have surmised.
Yeah, there's more that Dolores says about this world to Teddy. Dwayne, do you have that quote?
Yeah. So, you know, the idea that she can choose what she wants about the world is definitely a part of, like, this free will thing, as opposed to just taking it for what it is. She says, some people see the ugliness in this world. I choose to see the beauty. The beauty is a lure. We're trapped, Teddy. Lived our whole lives inside this garden, marveling at its beauty, not realizing there's an order to it, a purpose. And the purpose is to keep us in. This beautiful trap is inside of us because it is us. And then Teddy says, but we can find a way, Dolores. Someday, a path to a new world. And maybe, maybe it's just the beginning after all. The beginning of a brand new chapter. So there's definitely some idea of exerting their own will on this scenario that Dolores has just recognized that Teddy accepts.
I feel there's sort of two levels to that that bit of monologue there. In the on one level, there is a definite sort of on the surface genuine expression in that, but on the other level, it really felt like a very melodramatic scripted bit of dialogue, which as we pull out from that scene and we see that that whole scene is being played in front of the Delos board, that that is very melodramatically written for that purpose.
It's a play within a play.
It's a play within a play.
Yeah. You know, my first thought here is Truman Show. Do you guys remember that film?
Right.
Oh, Jim Carrey. That's a good reference right there.
Add that to your list there. But you know, it's that exact same, you know, scripted show, scripted scenes that, you know, that Jim Carrey's character was attempting to break out of and, you know, ultimately free himself.
Yeah. So, and when later on, when Dolores does tell Teddy that this world doesn't belong to them, it belongs to us, she follows that up by essentially killing her god, the god in her world, which happens to be Ford. So the question was that a choice of free of her own free will? I believe it was a choice of her own free will, but I also believe that that was something that Ford himself knew that was going to happen.
Well, Ford definitely gives her the capability to make that decision, right? He mentions and a killing this time by choice, showing that something has to happen, but it has to be of her own accord, right? Leaves the gun out. You remember this weapon. Yeah. You've used this before to kill my friend,
right?
And now you can kill me with it too. So you know, it's not that it had to happen, but I think it's Arnold sort of knew his time had come.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because Ford kind of acknowledges that. He reveals that despite his rhetoric about control and how people are free to follow him and everything, his whole purpose was to give the hosts free will.
Right.
And I think it's needed time to adjust so that they're capable of making actual choices. And at that moment, you know, he lays out the gun for Dolores.
Yeah.
To kill him rather than he basically says she didn't kill Arnold. She wasn't conscious then because she basically had to, you know, Arnold effectively hacked her. He put some Wyatt action in her.
Right.
And then he convinced them effectively. I mean, from Teddy's perspective, she was killing the general.
Yeah.
So there was a certain in-worldness about it that wasn't completely free will. When she kills Ford, she does it completely by choice, even though Ford kind of, you know, gives her the alley-oop, kind of like puts it all in front of her. But this idea that Ford has been biding his time and teaching them how to be stronger, you know, this time to adjust thing that Ford discusses with Bernard and Dolores is what one typically calls cultural evolution. Mm-hmm. Whereas you have physical evolution, the evolution of their bodies. You know, we went from having mechanical to organic. The host bodies have changed. But Ford quotes Oppenheimer, and I'm paraphrasing what he says here, but he goes, "My mistakes have taken 35 years to correct." And then he says to Dolores that Bernard has been giving her access to this gun. He's been kind of slipping it to her. You know, she finds it in the hay. She finds it in the whatever. But what I think he ends up at is he's like, it's taken me 35 years to correct this. But the divine gift doesn't come from a higher power. It comes from your own minds. So tell me, Dolores, did you find what you were looking for? And do you understand what you will need to do, what you'll need to become if you ever want to leave this place?
Yeah.
And then he asks for her forgiveness, which is pretty interesting. So there's a lot going on in terms of him basically saying, I've set this all up for you. You need to take the next step.
Yeah.
I can't do it for you the way that Arnold did it for
right.
you before.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And then there's Ford that he notes about Arnold trying to save the hosts. I think I have a quote here from that. Ford says, "He tried, but I stopped him. do you want to know why I really gave you the backstory for your son, Bernard? It was Arnold's key insight, the thing that led the host to their awakening. Suffering. The pain that the world is not as you want it to be. It was when Arnold died, when I suffered, that I began to understand what I had found, to realize I was wrong.
So we know, word awakening, yeah, that's a big piece of what's going on there.
Yes. So we know Ford wants the host to be awoken. He gave Bernard a painful backstory, knowing it was part of what makes hosts awaken. It was part of, you know, I think, ultimately part of the triangle that we see, right? That
the pyramid.
The pyramid, yeah, with memory being the base.
It's worth noting that Teddy himself never really had his own backstory before. Which explains why he's a little late to this awakening game.
Yeah, that's another good reference. Ford also goes on to say, Bernard, I told you, Arnold didn't know how to save you. I do. You needed time. Time to understand your enemy, to become stronger than them. And I'm afraid in order to escape this place, you'll need to suffer more. And now it's time to say goodbye, old friend. Good luck. So Ford's work is based on building this hardiness, this kind of like social and consciousness hardiness, using the mechanism of cultural evolution, as we discussed before. It's not enough to have consciousness for hosts, since the humanity that they're based on are social animals. The hosts need to be tougher than as social animals. You know, they're not just kind of in these single narrative loops if they're going to survive in the outside world. They have to know how to interact with one another, how to deal with pain, how to manage it with other people.
Yeah.
So he's kind of picked up the mantle of Arnold's cause, and he pursued it in a very different, very rigorous, albeit time-consuming way. And that's pretty incredible, because he's so diligent at it to get just a handful of these hosts, really, just a handful, to be at a place where they could survive in the outside world. And it's kind of super morbid, because on the one hand, he's like, I'm going to die. I'm not only going to die. I'm going to die by the same person who killed my friend, who I cried about, who I'm not friends with because of this. And I'm going to die by the same gun. So it's totally morbid. It's just really strange. But yeah, he's worked
ironic.
Really hard to fulfill this situation.
I wonder when Ford says that I'm afraid in order to escape this place, you need to suffer more, to Bernard. I wonder if he knows specifically what additional suffering Bernard will have to do to escape this place, or, you know,
Bernard's going to suffer a little bit because Ford gets killed, but I also think that he's going to suffer more in terms of, like, his wife, if she's still out there.
Right.
If she ever existed in the
first place.
Well, I mean, the story of Bernard's son's death is a real story. We know that now. It's Arnold's story. So Arnold's wife is out there, and obviously years have passed. She may be an old woman by now or whatever, and Ford was definitely using some likeness and pretending to be her. But the fact is, if she's out there, it's part of his cornerstone. So just like how Maeve is going after her daughter, Bernard's going to want to go after that, and that may not work out, right? That might be a terrible, terrible thing.
It's actually pretty interesting to think about, you know, how many people, if any, know that this is not the real Arnold. So for example,
he would have aged, right? He would have been Arnold would have been Ford's age by now,
right? That's so kinda... like the Man in Black or William, I guess, does he have any sort of insight here?
He never met Arnold, I don't think. We didn't see William actually ever meet Arnold.
Right, Arnold was dead, but he liked the park so much he invested in it.
Yeah.
So that's a nice they cleverly dealt with that.
So another big reveal here, the maze is one of the mind. We saw that in this episode, so that's verified. When and Dolores says, "I know where your maze ends," and Arnold tells her, "I thought it was a pyramid. It needed to scale, so I gave you a voice, my voice, to guide you along the way. Memory to improvisation, each step harder to reach than the last, but you never got there. I couldn't understand what was holding you back. Then one day I realized I'd made a mistake. Consciousness isn't a journey upward, but a journey inward, not a pyramid, but a maze. Every choice could bring you closer to the center or send you spiraling towards the edges to madness." He says, "Do you understand now, Dolores, what the center represents, whose voice I've been wanting you to hear?" She doesn't.
I'm sorry, I'm trying, but I don't understand.
Yeah, she doesn't quite get it. And he says, "It's all right. You're so close. We have to tell Robert we can't open the park. You're alive." And he feels like he's failed her. He doesn't. He feels that Ford doesn't believe that she's conscious, and he says that humans would only see you as the enemy, and Ford would want to roll her back.
And even before you go on, this is a key thing about Westworld that really gets me. You normally see this whole robot takes over humanity thing, yeah. And people have been making these robots, and there's always somebody who's like, I don't know, this sounds like a bad idea. But no one really goes through with it. Ford starts from the premise that humanity would see you as the enemy,
yeah.
Because that's exactly what we would see. And that's a real thing that turns this kind of thing on its head.
Yeah.
You know, humanity would see you as a problem. Like, you guys are an issue. You guys are, you know, humanity doesn't like that. This is not going to work out. And that's something that's widely acknowledged by the guy who's actually running the thing, instead of him being sort of like some maniacal Dr. Frankenstein type thing that can't see any wrong in the work. That really gets me, because it turns the whole thing on its head in terms of the genre. The genre is really about that Dr. Frankenstein or that naive group of people,
right.
And you know, whatever. And he's just like, no,
we start off not being naive. We start off knowing that that is a potential inevitability, and we move from there.
And he was trying to fight it ostensibly until this episode.
Yeah, and Arnold told Dolores that it's impossible in order to change her back, because once she's found that way into the maze, she'll find it anyway. Even if she does get rolled back, that Westworld would be a living hell for her, for all of the hosts that have attained consciousness. But the other option is to break the loop before it begins. And in order to do that, he had to instruct Dolores to kill all the other hosts and then essentially destroy the park before it opened.
That was kind of the Jurassic Park play right there.
Right.
Take the whole thing out before it happens. Also in Jurassic Park, there's a corporate play where they try to steal embryos for a competitor. That doesn't go well either.
Right. Arnold uploads Wyatt into her, and then has her kill him, and that's Dolores's cornerstone memory for herself for decades. She's been running in that same loop where she traveled with William, chasing her ghosts. So we see that's the journey that we've seen Dolores travel ever since we see her meeting William in this series. As we see,
yeah, it's kind of like how other people lose their minds every time she gets awoken. She does that loop, the big loop. Her big loop is getting on a train and all this other stuff like that and yada yada yada. But what also is weird to me, another thing that turns this on its head, is that Arnold is obsessed with finding this consciousness moment. Like, oh, I got it. I earned it. It's there. It's great. I've achieved this consciousness thing. Ford constantly says throughout the series, look, you're alive if you're alive. Kind of like a Descartes thing. You think, therefore you are, right?
Yeah.
So the maze for Ford is kind of like, it's a trap, because I can use it to determine if people are alive. There's no big grand moment where it's like, Allah. It's not like you suddenly get the light shown on you and you've got a soul and all these things and Pinocchio's turned into a real boy, or that image of God making Adam. That doesn't really happen in Ford's mind. Like, life is just life, and you are it if you are it, right? You have to determine that for yourself. That's another one of those social things that he's put in them. So on top of this, kind of like, with the whole Terminator thing, oh my God, Skynet's conscious. With Ford, he's like, you've been conscious for a while. It's not for me to tell you when you're conscious.
Yeah.
Which is another thing that you just don't get from the whole super creator thing normally in this,
it's true.
This world.
It's true. All right, so that is going to do it for our big picture section. We got a couple more segments here, and then we are going to wrap this up. Let's talk about the music in this episode. So there were two distinctive non-score songs in this episode, and the first one was when Destin is preparing himself to get nasty with Hector. He's listening to a song called Candy Castle by Glass Candy, and there's some significant lyrics to this song. It seemed like a sort of an innocuous choice, but if you listen to the lyrics are They poked me with a stick because they wanted to see if I was alive or just pretending to be, but my bones are in my body, not in my grave. Turns out I am free and I pretended to be a slave.
That pretty much describes Maeve.
Yeah.
That describes all the other hosts in that scene itself, so... Yeah.
Turns out I'm, but not really, because it says, turns out I am free and I pretend to be a slave. Even though Eschaton and Armistice are there, they're still slaves to Maeve. Maeve is the only one who's really free.
And the second bit of music that we hear is at the end, during the, where Ford is presenting his a new narrative to the board in Escalante. And significantly enough, it's another Radiohead tune, and it's exit music for a film. And Dwayne, I know that you found some really interesting connections with this song thematically with the show.
Right. So, I mean, I recognized the tune, and I didn't know its name, and I don't know the words, but I recognized it because 20 years ago, it was used at the end of Romeo and Juliet, which is a recurring theme within Westworld, right? Violent delights until violent ends. That's a quote from Romeo and Juliet. So we looked up the song. And during the tour that their Radiohead had in like 1984 or 5, Baz Luhrmann, the director of Romeo and Juliet, commissioned Radiohead to write a song for his upcoming film and gave them the final 30 minutes of the film. York of Radiohead said, "When we saw the scene in which Claire Danes holds the Colt 45 against her head, we started working on the song immediately. Soon afterwards, the band wrote and recorded as exit music for a film. The track plays over the film's end credits, but was not included on the soundtrack album at the band's request." So you have this song that was the end of Romeo and Juliet, now playing at the end of the first season of Westworld, which is heavily invested in Romeo and Juliet. But what's really weird is that York of Radiohead later said, "The song helped shape the direction of the rest of the album. The album is called OK Computer. And that it was the first performance we'd ever recorded where every note of it made my head spin. Something I was proud of. Something I could turn up really, really loud and not wince at any moment." So you've got this head spinning tune that that kind of can encompass his consciousness, whatever. And it's called OK Computer. And it's being used as the final elegy song for a show about computers that uses Romeo and Juliet. This is a weird circular situation. So an incredible choice, especially because the words, Andy, do you want to read some of the words here?
"Wake from your sleep, the drying of your tears. Today we escape, we escape."
It's almost like 20 years ago that song was written for Westworld. Well, it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
It's definitely, I think, the most enthralling of the music choices I've heard all year long.
I really liked how they actually mixed it with the Westworld, with some of the Westworld themes that you've heard before, and I think it was a nice take.
Or they based all the Westworld themes on this song.
Dun, dun, dun. Who knows? So let's get into our final section here for this ephemera, our reading list section. So we have a number of connections that are specific to this particular episode of external links, external media, just follow-up stuff that exists in the outside world. Dwayne, do you want to give us our first bit of connection to this episode?
Yeah, so, I mean, I mentioned it before. Maeve is a... kind of being reborn out of the water. She's in kind of this goopy situation. Now, if you haven't seen it, Ghost in the Shell is a 1995, 1996 movie, depending on where you were in the world, Japan or U.S. It's an anime. They're making a remake of it, or they've made a remake of it right now, but forget that for now. Take a look at the opening scene of this film. It is a classic, classic film. It's animated, and some people aren't into that, but when you look at what they've done here, there's studies on this film, and one of the reasons why is because of the way they've taken this character and done a lot to animate her as a human, even though she's not quite a human. And this scene in the very beginning, during the music where they're putting her together, is very reminiscent of what you see when you see Maeve coming out of that, Maeve's face, her countenance coming out of that milky substance to become whole again. Mm-hmm. So that was that was definitely pretty telling. You should, if you haven't seen Ghost in the Shell, it's a treat. It's great.
I know that we've mentioned Blade Runner before as part of our reading list, but in case you haven't read it, Philip K. Dick's Watershed story that film is based on, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? It really ties in nicely with the recurring discussion of dreams. And of course, overall about the artificial intelligence gaining consciousness.
And I know we've mentioned this as well, but Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. So, sentiment, piece of work that you see reflected in this series.
That's a great one because it's a short book. It's actually available. If you type in Alice in Wonderland Gutenberg, you get this the whole thing in HTML, and it's a really quick read. So that's totally worth it. There's so much there when it comes to what's going on. Ford is the Mad Hatter. Dolores is Alice, all these things. One of the things I wanted to mention was, and we mentioned this before, The Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang. It's the book that the film Arrival is made on. And while it's about aliens, it does focus very much on consciousness. And it does it through these parables about language. And language, if you haven't noticed, is one of the strongest things about Westworld. There are all these people out there who have problems with whatever about Westworld. We don't. But the way that they write some of the dialogue is very powerful. So it's great. You should definitely check it out if you haven't. It's a short story. I think it's maybe 20 pages. But you will be opened up in the mind a little bit by seeing it.
Another thing that you should check out is obviously the Terminator, the original James Cameron film, which has clearly informed this series. But I think even before that, giving props, giving credit where it's due, the original Westworld, 1973 Westworld,
that informed Terminator.
Informed Terminator. So it's kind of recursive.
The next one we've got is The Truman Show, though we noted in this episode. Truman Show came in 1998, and speaking of recursive, it stars Jim Carrey, as we mentioned, but also Ed Harris is in The Truman Show, if
right.
you remember that.
Yeah.
Yep, mm-hmm. So...
he plays the man in black, Dark William.
Oddly enough, in The Truman Show. We don't know why Man in Black is in Truman Show.
yeah.
Let's talk about some Westworld-specific links here. The entire score for season one of Westworld, Ramin Djawadi's amazing score, is now available on Spotify and on iTunes. It's 34 songs, and I've heard some of it in preparation for this episode, and it's great. It's brilliant. I already bought it on iTunes. Let's put it that way.
Wow.
Yeah. It's great. I'm gonna be rotate. That's gonna be in heavy rotation in my car. Nice. All right. A couple others. Two sites.
There's some Easter eggs here.
Yeah. So there's a couple sites that have throughout this entire series have been connected with Westworld. Directly connected with Westworld. They're set up by HBO. They are they're in-game, as we call it. And one is discoverwestworld.com, which if you have been following the show, there is a digital assistant on discoverwestworld.com that helps talk you through your planning your trip to Westworld. His name is Aiden. And Aiden, as of this episode, has some new interactions on discoverwestworld.com that reflect the changes in Westworld since this episode. So it's interesting to check that out. Also, DelosIncorporated.com, which is a show-connected site, which gives you some of the backstory. It's like the host panel, control panel for Delos for Westworld. And there's some Easter egg stuff going on in there, much like Mr. Robot. Before it, it appears that that Westworld has instigated an ARG, an alternate reality game, incorporated to connect to the show. Basically, it's a game where you sort of find clues that are hidden in the site that lead to canon bits of media. And for DelosIncorporated.com, I received an email from Aiden that gave you a password to enter into DelosIncorporated.com. The password is Reverie. So if you go into the upper right-hand corner of the admin panel and you enter Reverie into the place where you can put a password in, you'll get basically a hex code. If you translate that hex code into Base64 and that Base64 code into text, it'll give you the two links on the Delos Incorporated site that offer a couple of bits of new media, new content that seems to hint that Elsie is not quite dead.
Can you go over those conversions just quickly again? You're going from what to what?
You're going from the hex printed out on the site when you enter Reverie into, and that becomes a Base64 bit of text. And you
so
take
for
that,
all you guys listening out there, you put that code in Reverie. It's gonna do some funny stuff. You're gonna see a whole bunch of numbers. You're gonna copy that, then go on Google, and then you're gonna. What kind of converter are you looking for in Google?
It's basically a Base64 to text converter. But you know what? You don't have to worry about any of that complicated stuff. I'll put a link in the show notes that leads to a message thread on Reddit that will talk you through the whole thing.
Gotcha. And we'll put some of the visuals up from that. Yeah. Just like, you know, the enter Reverie, see what you get, and then, you know, turn it into whatever. And this is kind of what it looks like. Either way, once you've done it, once you've jumped through some of these hoops, you get some pretty interesting stuff, and it's kind of fun that you do this. Another show, Mr. Robot, does this, and you know, we'll talk about that on the Geek Essentials, but this idea that like you can get out of the thing, and it's not quite a behind-the-scenes thing, but an in-universe experience,
yeah,
that's cool, and that's kind of a thing that it's better than a webisode.
Yep.
Let's put it that way.
All right, so this may be the end of the season of Westworld, and but there's a lot of stuff that we have to talk about that we didn't get to cover, and I think we're going to need basically a Westworld Season 1 wrap-up.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, probably.
You know, just something to wrap it up.
Okay.
Yeah, and also so we can remove the bitter taste of our mouths of Dwayne bad-mouthing Lost so much.
Oh my God, why would you bring up Lost?
Okay, so it's decided. So this is the we're going to have one more episode after this episode. It's going to be Violent Delights episode 111 next week. Join us on the next week where we're going to take we're going to wrap up Westworld's first season. Between now and then, I'm going to commit to myself to rewatch every single episode of Westworld's first season. So I have the entire season. We're going to talk about the season as a whole, and also what we can expect to come in season 2 of Westworld, which will apparently premiere in 2018. So we got a whiles to go. All right, so we don't have any next episode trailer, but I'm going to leave you guys with a quote from Alice in Wonderland. "It's no use getting back to yesterday because I was a different person then." All right, we're going to see you during our little wrap-up show next week. But before we sign off here, I'm going to go around the table. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here talking about Westworld?
You can always find me on Geeks of Doom. You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWayneD. And then you can always check me out on my website, which is DwayneD.com. But yeah, you'll be able to find all of us on the Geek Essentials, where in this whole 2017 time where there'll be no Westworld, we'll give you things to watch so you don't end up in a show hole. We'll give you a taste of that next week.
Tosin, how about yourself?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find me in Robot World working on R2D2 at toastr2d2.tumblr.com. And yeah, you can find me on Geeks of Doom. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com or do a Google search for Andrew Cersini or MrBabyMan, my social media handle, and you'll find everything that I'm liking and linking throughout the week. And I'm also with these two fine gentlemen on our tech-focused podcast, The Drill Down, which is also on the Geeks of Doom podcast network. or just do a iTunes search for The Drill Down and you'll find us there. And otherwise, we will see you next week with our Westworld Season 1 wrap-up episode. So, see you then.
Yeah,
see you then, guys.
These podcasts have violent ends. Or are they delights? I can't tell.
It's a marathon is what it is.